Hello. It's June 5th, 2025. My name is Simone, and this is 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. Like always, I hope you all have had a great week so far and are looking forward to the weekend. And today's episode is about a case that many of you may have heard about, but I still wanted to bring it to you. To your attention and to your knowledge, I guess, especially for those who haven't heard this story. And there are so many elements to this case that it will be a part two, like a part one and two type episode, filled with so many unanswered questions about a heinous crime. And with that, let's dive in to today's part one episode. The year was 1996, and in the city of Boston, Massachusetts, it was bustling. Tech startups were quietly taking root in Kendall Square and along Route 128, which some referred to as quote-unquote America's Technology Highway. Few outside the industry noticed, but this marked the early formation of Boston's next economic identity, one that was slowly moving away from its manufacturing and financial past. Despite leaning towards economic change, however, reports state that during this time, Boston was experiencing one of the most significant projects in modern history, which it named the Central Artery Tunnel Project. However, due to the project's considerable impact on residents, locals eventually came to refer to it as the Big Dig. Reports state that the Big Dig was supposed to be a $2.8 billion project to bury the I-93 expressway and provide quote-unquote breathing room to local drivers. However, to locals, it actually meant detours, delays, and constant noise and frustrations. However, despite the challenges of this project, many locals and visitors still enjoy the entertainment Boston had to offer, especially with their many sports teams like the MLB team, the Red Sox, even if their season ended in disappointment, the NBA team, the Celtics, who were rebuilding their reputation, and the NHL team, the Bruins, who were doing just okay. However, if sports weren't a certain Bostonian's thing, though, you could catch many of them vibing to Boston's music scene with a blend of indie rock, punk revival, and hip-hop. Clubs like the Paradise Rock Club in the Middle East in neighboring Cambridge introduced many local and national acts. Despite the club scene and the other fun of the city, though, underneath, like any old city with a complicated past, there were cracks. As some venues in the city pulsed into the early hours, certain alleyways of Boston felt too quiet after midnight. And as a result, many people vanished as the sun went down. This was unfortunately the case of a young woman who was new to the country, who went out one summer night in Boston looking for some simple fun. However, little did she know that the new life she planned to learn in this new country would be shattered when her body, or what was left of it, would be found in the most grotesque way. And her case would be one of Boston's most infamous murders in history. In the following case, you'll find out who the victim was, the investigation, and more in a case I title, What Happened After the Club, Part 1. On the evening of Saturday, June 22nd, 1996, the nightlife of Boston was alive with the usual weekend party scene. The city's bars, clubs, and restaurants were filled with energy and young people out enjoying their Saturday night. Down on Lansdowne Street, the music was loud, the drinks were flowing, and the crowd was dancing until the early morning hours. Some were celebrating the start of summer, while others sought an escape from their daily workload. The streets of the South End and the Theater District were also lively with the sounds of laughter and small talk as people spilled out of late-night diners and cafes. For most, it was just another weekend in Boston, carefree and full of life, and far from the tragedy that was quietly unfolding in the shadows of the city. Reports state that hours later, between 2 and 3 a.m. on June 23rd, a homeless man familiar with the alleyways of the South End was making his way through piles of garbage in various dumpsters in the area. When he came across a particular dumpster near Fenway Park, he rummaged through the trash, trying to find cans and collectibles. When he came across a garbage bag that seemed heavier than usual. When the man lifted the bag, reports state he was excited as he thought he would find something valuable inside since it was unusually heavy. However, when he ripped the bag open, what he found inside was not something that could be sold. Instead, it was the horrific sight of a body inside. 911 was alerted, and as emergency personnel made their way onto the scene, they examined the bag and noticed not only the body of a young woman inside, but only half of her was in the bag, being that of her upper half, which included her arms and attached her hands with a pristine manicure. The body was found in the dumpster located at the corner of Ipswich and Boylston Streets, behind a 5-story brick apartment building named the Boylston that was also not far from the Boston Conservatory. However, reports state that in this area of Boston, despite housing some of the city's landmarks like the conservatory and one of the public libraries, when night fell, reports state some seedy activity occurred here, like fights, drug deals, and prostitution. And when the news broke about the woman's body found in the dumpster, many in the neighborhood thought that was who the victim was, a lady of the evening. After all, reports state that back on June 13th, the body of alleged sex worker Dolores Johnson was found in the neighborhood, having been murdered. So many thought the cases could have been connected. Some nearby employees in the neighborhood also thought the victim found in the dumpster was an alleged sex worker as well, with a security guard telling the press, quote-unquote, "They do their tricks in the alley back there. You come in at 6 a.m., and you'll see them." Meanwhile, while detectives were investigating the gruesome murder, reports state other officers who worked in the nearby precinct were working on a missing persons case filed by a group of young women who worked as au pairs who said their friend and fellow au pair was missing since she did not come home after a night of partying on June 21st. The officers put two and two together and wondered if, tragically, the woman found in the dumpster was their missing friend. Reports state police asked the group of friends what she looked like, and they described her as white, blonde, and having a distinctive sun-shaped tattoo. When investigating officers compared the friend's description to that of the severed body, they determined that this was indeed their missing friend, and her name was Karina Homer. According to reports, 19-year-old Karina Homer was born Karina Erica Homer on September 7, 1975, in Sweden, to a Swedish father named Ola and a German mother whose name was not disclosed to the press. Karina's parents raised her and her three sisters in a small dairy farming village with fewer than 100 residents. And as she grew older, Karina became known as a headstrong, intelligent, animal-loving, and ambitious young woman. At the age of 8, she joined a scouting organization where she excelled in various outdoor activities. And it was during this time that she discovered her wanderlust, a strong desire to travel and see the world beyond her small town. However, as a child, she had to wait until she was older and financially independent to pursue her dream. Fast forwarding to 1994, though, when Karina graduated from high school, her determination had not waned. She already knew what she wanted to do with her life, which was to build a career in the hospitality world. And after high school, Karina took courses to learn about the restaurant business. She worked as a waitress and chef for 2 years in the city of Jönköping, apparently 40 minutes away from her hometown. Despite her knowledge and her career, however, Karina still earned very little money, and she still harbored dreams of traveling the world. Reports state that Karina was so desperate for money that she spent a lot of time playing lottery scratch-offs called Trislot in hopes of finding fortune or at least money to travel. But as luck would have it for Karina, as she was figuring out how to make more money to travel, she came across an ad for an agency for local young Swedish women to nanny for children in America without a visa. Karina thought that now she had finally gotten her chance to travel around the world, so she contacted the agency to apply for this trip, and she was accepted. Although this was happy news for Karina, what didn't come with the new position was a lot of income. She could barely even afford the trip, but again, as luck would have it for Karina, as she continued to use scratch-offs, reports state that in early 1996, one scratch-off literally paid off, and she won 10,000 krona, which is around $1,500. And she now had her money for the trip. According to reports, in March 1996, Karina, again, even without the visa, made her way to the U.S., and expecting her were a couple living in Dover, Massachusetts, named Frank Rapp and Susan Nichter, who were the parents of two small children, one school-aged and the other a toddler. Reports state that after Karina began working for the family, she enjoyed it initially, and the children adored her. Karina also loved a perk that came with the job. While she worked at the family home Monday through Friday in Dover, Frank allowed Karina to stay in his work studio in the much more lively South Boston, so she could relax before getting back to work the following week. Also, soon after her arrival, Karina met and became friends with other fellow Swedish au pairs, and when she had the apartment to herself on the weekends, her au pair friends would hang out with her there. Additionally, the apartment was where Karina and her friends would get ready and possibly pregame before heading out into Boston's nightlife. Karina was said to be enjoying her life in America a lot. She loved that she was getting paid to care for children she adored, had free rein in her employer's apartment on the weekend to have closer access to parties, and reports state that while in the Boston area, she enjoyed the attention she received from young men. Karina was said to have explored her options with young men in the party scene and with those who held everyday jobs. She also shared her exciting experiences with her family and friends back home, as well as her anticipation of discovering more adventures around Boston. However, a few months after Karina arrived in America and sent her exciting letters, according to reports, her feelings about her time here began to change. For example, although she loved her au pair position, Karina didn't like how her employers expected her to frequently clean the Dover home and cook often, with one report stating that she wrote one of her friends back home about this and said in part, quote unquote, "There is always so much cleaning and I think I'm stressed all the time. So this is not exactly what I thought it would be." And even though Karina seemed to enjoy the nightlife with her fellow au pairs and things seemed to be going fine, reports state that a few weeks before her body was found, Karina wrote to another friend and said she planned to cut her visit in America short and that life in America was not as she had planned and hoped. Then, in another letter, Karina wrote in part something sinister and said, quote unquote, "Something terrible has happened. I cannot tell you right now what it is, but I will tell you when I get home." After her last letter was sent to her friend back home in Sweden, reports indicate that Karina didn't share her feelings with her friends in Boston or her employer, and she continued with her usual duties while harboring her feelings. She also continued to party on weekends, and by June 1996, some excitement returned to Karina, when on the night of June 21st, she and her friends went out to celebrate the summer solstice. Now, reports state that in the U.S., the summer solstice wasn't celebrated like it was in Sweden, with reports stating that the holiday over there was celebrated like a massive celebration fit with festivals, decorating neighborhoods with greenery, bonfires, dancing around maypoles, and more. It's unclear if Karina and her friends did all of these activities in Boston for the holiday, but what is known is that after they got ready at Frank's apartment, they all headed out to one of their favorite bars in town, which was the club Zanzibar. Zanzibar, according to a report, was a relatively new club around this time, and a 1988 article said of the club in part, "This new dance club is a Banana Republic fantasy, complete with palm fronds, wicker settees, and waitresses in khaki hot pants. In other words, goofy suburban fun." Here at Zanzibar, Karina and her girls received a great deal of attention again from their fellow partiers, and they danced the night away while sipping on cocktails. However, reports state that as the night progressed, Karina allegedly had a lot to drink to the point where staff noticed. One report states that staff began to worry about Karina's alcohol consumption to the point where one bartender started giving her juice to drink. Then another bartender gave her water, until another bartender suggested they stop serving her altogether and let her sober up on her own. However, another report states Karina allegedly did not sober up and ended up allegedly passing out in the women's restroom. By this point, the staff at Zanzibar were growing annoyed with Karina's actions, and at around 3 a.m., conflicting reports state that the staff was about to escort her out and arrange a ride for her, or Karina left the club on her own. Reports also state, however, that after Karina left the club, witnesses allegedly saw her speaking with a homeless man outside near the club, and the two also reportedly danced and sang for a few minutes before Karina wandered back off. Meanwhile, back at Zanzibar, as the club was shutting down for the night, Karina's friends realized they had lost her, and they had a difficult time trying to find her. Little did they know, though, that after a night of exhilarating fun, they would end up hearing the story of nightmares when their good friend Karina eventually was found in the most ghastly way. And that's it for part one of what happened after the club. And on part two, which will be released very soon, I promise, I will dive more into the night of Karina's last night, the investigation, her employers, Frank and Susan, and much more. Again, even though this is only part one of this story, thank you for tuning in. And if you found the story fascinating, please leave a rating and review on the podcast platform you listen to 90s Crime Time if you haven't already. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you very soon with What Happened After the Club, Part 2.